Okay, this is Ken Samuelson. Today's date is November the 5th, 2002. And I live at 545 Southwood Drive in Eden, North Carolina. My telephone number is 336-623-7787. And I'm here with Mr. Bethel Griffith, who is a veteran, a Marine veteran of World War II. And Mr. Griffith, would you identify yourself for the listening audience?
I'm Bethel Griffith. I live at 619 Fraker Place in Eden, North Carolina. My telephone number is 336-623-8076.
And where were you, and when were you born and where?
I was born September 3rd, 1925 in Patrick County, Virginia.
That's a stone's throw from here, huh?
Yeah, up in the hills.
Okay. So born in 1925, so you were pretty young when you were in the service then, weren't you?
I was 17.
A young man. You went to high school, I assume, in Patrick County, or did you?
No, I never entered high school.
Never entered high school.
I started in the eighth grade at Felixville High School.
Uh-huh.
Went 6 weeks and quit, went to work.
Oh, really? Where did you work?
Sawmill.
Worked at the sawmill here locally in the...
My brother owned a sawmill and he needed help and I had no place to live. I had no place to eat. I had no...
Really? Your family?
I had nobody to send me to school, so
I
went to work at a sawmill about 30 cents an hour.
I see. So you kind of left where you were and came down here, huh? Okay. So you were just a very young man when you went to work. And you worked... until you entered the service, I take it then, at the sawmill, or did you?
Yeah, that wasn't long. I worked two or three little jobs. I worked sawmill for a while, and I think the last 6 months I worked for Fieldcrest Mills.
Oh, really?
I went to work in there and worked. I made big money there. I made $14.40 a week.
I can relate to that when I was a kid.
I worked there 6 months, and then the war started, and I started trying to get in.
So you were working at Fieldcrest then on December 7th, 1941. Is that the idea?
I'm not sure whether that... I think war started about that time. I think around that time that I quit.
You quit, okay. And wanted to get in the service.
Yeah.
Why did you want to get in the service?
I don't know. I just felt everybody else was going. There was nobody left here.
Now, you were only 16 years old.
Like,
and
I was like 16 and a half, 17 years old,
right.
And there was nothing on Washington Street. I sit on a corner down there where First National Bank used to be, across the street from it, for 8 hours one day, and two cars went by.
Yeah, I can believe that.
There was nobody to talk to.
Yeah.
So lonesome and everything, and I started trying to find a way to get in service. And
did you feel kind of out of place in the fact that you weren't in the service?
Yeah, I wasn't old enough to go.
No, but
I was in a hurry to go. So
yeah.
I tried to get in the Navy. I tried to get in the Coast Guard. Tried to get in the Army.
Now
they all said, come back when you get 18.
You couldn't join when you were 17, I
think. You could, but somebody had to sign for you. So I talked my dad into signing for me. And then they wouldn't take me in because I was going to be drafted in 5-6 months. They wouldn't let me volunteer because I was going to be drafted. So somebody told me if I'd go to some insurance agent and buy a life insurance policy for about a nickel a week and tell them I was born last year, you know, I could get in earlier. Said they can use that for proof.
So
I bought a 5-cent insurance policy and dated March 10th. And
1924 then?
Yeah.
And
they
earlier.
On March 10th, 1925, according to them, I was 17, and my dad signed for me to go, and I left here.
How about it?
And I went.
So you went in then in 1942, is that?
Same day that our friend went in at
Bill Lashley?
Went in, 9 guys from Eden went on that bus from here.
Is that right?
And when we got to Fort Jackson, all 9 of us joined the Marines.
How about it?
We got a discharge from the Army. Stayed there 3 days, I think. And
did you join the Army first? Is that the idea?
We were drafted in the Army.
Oh, you were drafted. Okay.
Yeah, we were drafted in the Army, but my dad had to sign a paper before we could draft me because I was
Because you were underage.
Underage.
Yeah. Okay. So the Army drafted you there?
The Army drafted me, and we spent the night in the Army. And the only ones I can remember is J.D. Glasgow and Bill Lashley and Roy Curry. But there was nine of us. And these two Marines drove up in a 1940 model Chevrolet Woody station wagon.
Yeah.
And got out with them blue, red, blue uniforms on, you know, and said them stripes from the elbow up to the shoulder, and said we're looking for 10 good men.
So that's how you got into the Marine Corps.
That's right.
Okay. And now, where was this? Where were you located now when this happened?
That was in Fort Jackson.
Fort Jackson, South Carolina. Fort Jackson. And when you went into the service, just backtrack a second. How did you get down to Fort Jackson?
We rode a bus. It was a, actually it was a cattle car, I think, that they converted into a bus and pulled it with a tractor and trailer.
No kidding.
An old 40 or 41 model red international truck. We couldn't, you know, this went back in a trailer. And that thing took 2 days to get to Parris Island. They stopped everywhere and picked up more recruits. By the time we got there, it was packed full.
No kidding. You had very, that wasn't a very comfortable ride, I guess, was it?
No, it was terrible. And I think we went into, we didn't get all the way to Parris Island. We got in Yamasee, South Carolina, about midnight, I think. And there's a couple of Marine sergeants there waiting for us. And they bunked us down there in a temporary barracks.
I see.
And took us into the base the next morning.
Uh-huh.
Shaved our head and we was there.
Now, when you got that cattle car or whatever, truck, whatever it was, composite or something, got to Parris Island then, what were you greeted with when you got there?
I mean,
was there a top sergeant there that was...
I thought two of the meanest men in the world, a sergeant named, is Sergeant Croft.
Uh-huh.
And he had to be the meanest man in the world. He called us everything in the book.
This is right as you got off. Yeah. Right as you got off the thing, huh?
Yeah. Scared us to death, but it didn't take long to get into the routine.
Now, how long were you at Parris Island?
Well, I was supposed to have been there, I think, 10 or 11 weeks, and I was in the same platoon that Bill and the other guys was in, was all in the same platoon.
Uh-huh.
And it might have been in there a week, 2 weeks, something like that, and doing calisthenics one morning, the guy in the front of me kicked me in the mouth with a heel of a brand new combat boot, cut a hole through my lip, knocked a tooth loose.
Oh, boy.
And they looked at it and said, be all right. Just, you know, so the next morning I fell out for work and it done got infected. And so sergeant sent me to the hospital, base hospital. And they kept me down there for a week, and I lost my platoon, had to join another one.
Oh.
So I was about 2 weeks later graduating from Parris Island, and the rest of the guys did.
Did you have any trouble from that tooth, or did they fix it up okay?
They fixed it up okay, but they discovered something else while I was there. I had a polyp in my nose, and they took that out too.
Oh.
And
that's why it took a week to
get out. Yeah, that's why it took a week.
Yeah. Tell me what your day was like at Parris Island. Now, excuse me, from the first time you arrived, now they shaved your head. Did they issue you a set of fatigues, or what kind of uniform did you...
They issued us fatigues, and we got two undershirts, and two pair of skivvies, and two pair of pants, and two jackets, and a pair of boondockers, and a pith helmet, they call it.
Right.
And we had to change clothes every day, and we had to put on clean clothes every day.
So you had to wash clothes
every other day? We had to wash clothes every night.
Every night, basically, yeah. So how did you wash your clothes?
In the latrine, go to the latrine and bang them in, wash them in a basin and beat them on the floor and hang them up. And we'd hang them, we was in Quonset huts, and we'd hang them up behind our Quonset huts.
Yeah.
And then some of the lazy guys, that too lazy to wash their clothes, would steal them. They didn't call it stealing, they just confiscated them during the night. And so one story I never will forget, they done confiscated both of my T-shirts. And a sergeant got to where he'd make us open my vest, see if we had it on. And he walked up in front of me in the line one morning, I didn't have a skivvy shirt on. Well, he promised me that if I didn't have a skivvy shirt on, tomorrow morning when I fell out, that he would give me every dirty detail there was on the island to do, done, including dig a 6x6. And so the next morning I fell out, and he was tickled to death. I had a t-shirt on. He walked up to me and said, "Griff, you got a t-shirt on?" Said, "Yes, sir." And he jerked my coat open and had Sergeant Croft on it. he got so tickled he just let it go.
How did you get that t-shirt, man?
I got it off the line behind my tent. I thought it was mine.
Okay, so that was a wrong one to get.
That was the answer I gave him.
That's funny. So tell me what your day was like when you were at Parris Island. I mean, what time did you get up in the morning?
We had no certain time to get up. Anytime that sergeant hollered, you better be up in 15 seconds.
And that would be at any time in the morning?
Any time, day or night, or whenever.
It could be at 3 o'clock in the morning?
Could be at 3 o'clock in the morning, could be at 10 o'clock at night, any time.
Uh-huh. And what would you likely find yourself doing if he woke you at, say, 3 in the morning?
Doing calisthenics, marching, doing what you call it, the rotation of the rifle, you know, handling the weapons and things like that. They kept us busy.
Now, how much sleep did you normally get?
I think we got plenty of sleep, but it wasn't all at one time.
It was all interrupted, huh?
Yeah.
But so you got enough rest, but you did have a lot of interruptions.
Yeah,
to
I got
that
used
sleep,
to it.
Huh?
Got used to it, I guess, after a while.
Well, of course, they were trying to make a point with you, too, I guess. The fact that you rest, catch as catch can, huh?
Yep.
On your rest. So you did a lot of drilling?
A lot of it. We didn't have any liberties at all in Boot
Camp. No liberties, okay.
Maybe on Sunday, if you're lucky enough to have a dime or a quarter in your pocket, they let you go, let somebody go to the PX and buy you a bar of candy or something on Sunday, maybe. But it'd be mighty good through the week if they'd done that.
Yeah. How about conditioning?
Conditioning?
You know, actually getting in your tip-top physical shape, did you?
I went in that Marine Corps boot camp down there as a 17-year-old kid, and I came out as a grown man.
What did you weigh going in and coming out? Do you recollect?
I weighed 135 pounds when I came out.
Uh-huh.
And that's the most I weighed for the next 2 years. I weighed more than that before I went in.
Yeah, so you lost.
I didn't have an ounce of fat on my body anywhere when I came out of this. All muscle.
Would you say? Yeah, that's what I was going to ask. Would you feel like you were really well conditioned when you got out?
Absolutely, best shape.
Okay, so you were in the best condition of your life, and as I said, your training down there, was it as bad? You know, with the gnats and the bugs and the water and the muck and everything you were. Was it as bad as anything you faced later on? Standpoint of the physical environment that you were in?
No, I don't think so. I think I've run into some things worse than that later on.
Worse than that later on. Okay. I figured you probably.
Yeah, I know I did. And one of the things that I remember this all my life from the very day that first time I went in combat. I ain't never forgot about it since then. When I was at Parris Island, when they handed me that bayonet and told me to put it on the end of my rifle and we're going to train you how to kill with a bayonet. I said, not me. I talked to myself. I said, not me. I ain't never getting that close to a Jap. I'll shoot them from a distance, but I ain't going to get close enough to hit one with a bayonet. I could eat them words. I didn't practice down there. I avoided it, you know. Mm-hmm. I faked it. And when I got over there, then I didn't know how to use a bayonet and I needed one.
Yeah. On exploring the bayonet practice, how realistic was that bayonet practice? I mean, you're dealing with a sharp instrument, and how did you avoid, you know, hurting each other when you did that?
Well, in practicing, the bayonet really hadn't been sharpened. It looked like it was sharp, but it wasn't. But they didn't actually jab you with them. They'd go around you.
Yeah, well,
you could bump shoulders with each other and fight with them, but
they didn't have a blunt end.
I was reluctant to even try to learn how to do it because this is useless for me. I'm not going to get that close to a Jap.
You figured you'd be shooting that weapon first before you ever got that close. And it didn't work that way, apparently.
Didn't work out that way.
So you were at Parris Island for, 11, 12 weeks, was it?
I think I was there for 12 or 13 weeks in all. Okay. I spent about 2 weeks in a hospital, though.
Right. Okay, did you feel that the training you received there really prepared you for what you were going to face?
Yes, I did.
Was it that realistic?
When I left there and I got on that bus going home, I felt the best I'd ever felt in my life. I felt like somebody. I felt like that I was on my way to knowing what I was going to do in my life. And I uh-huh. helped somebody else, I'd do something, you know.
Yeah.
And I just felt good about everything.
So you felt and well prepared.
I became a man down there in about 10, 11 weeks.
I can believe it. Did you see that happen to other people, friends of yours?
Many of them. Very few failed. When the ones that did fail, we never heard from them again.
Uh-huh. Now, when you were down there, you say you got no liberty at all.
No liberty of any kind.
You're just on duty basically 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, huh?
No movies. If we went to a movie, it was an educational movie.
Mm-hmm. And I guess you had plenty of those, too.
Had plenty of those. Usually had them about 3 o'clock in the morning.
Did you develop close friendships down there? Or were you all kind of so intent on doing your own thing that...
At Parris Island, my platoon came pretty close, but we never saw one another after we left. After we got discharged from there, I never seen either. Never run across any of them anymore.
Never ran across them, huh? So you all went your various ways, huh?
I guess at the time, he'd have been a kind of a celebrity that went through boot camp with us. In a way, he was. We didn't know it. He is a Cuban.
Mm-hmm.
Name was Franco. That's all I can remember. We called him Frankie.
Mm-hmm.
And at the time we didn't even know he was Cuban. Mm-hmm. But he graduated boot camp with us. And when we were standing at attention on the field at graduation day, the general came by and interviewed the troops. And he walked right up to Franco and stopped in front of him and called him by his name. And says, I hear you're from Cuba and you're up here to go through our boot camp. Yes, sir, Your Honor. And they said, general smiled at him, said, well, be at ease, Franco. How do you like Parris Island? What do you think of Parris Island now that you've been here? He says, well, sir, he said, I heard all my life that this used to be a naval prison camp. That general could put a big smile on and say, yes, sir, it sure did. He said, by God, I think it still is.
Who was this guy, do you know?
He was somebody from the Cuban government that was going to the embassy in Washington, and they wouldn't let him go up there until he finished boot camp.
Is that right?
He wasn't even a Marine. He just going through boot camp with us.
Isn't that interesting?
So the general didn't have much to do with him.
So the day you graduated, how did you feel that day?
Well, I felt like I was the luckiest person in the world. I got a PFC coming out of boot camp.
Uh-huh. And what did the others get?
Well, 10% of them got PFC. The rest of them stayed where they was at.
I see.
Except Franco. I don't know what he got. He wasn't even a Marine.
Yeah, right.
And one guy got out. He was staff sergeant like another fellow we know was.
Oh.
But he was in radar, too. He was a radar specialist when he came in.
Uh-huh. Well, that's what Bill Ashley was, the radar
so
specialist.
So he was staff. They gave him staff sergeant's rate when they inducted him.
Uh-huh.
But he had to be a private when he's in boot camp.
I see. Okay, so you graduated. You felt really good. You went on a leave, I guess. Came home. Is that
10-day leave, I believe, and 10-day furlough transfer to Camp Lejeune.
Okay, so you were here in the Leakesville area then, Eden area?
I was here for 10 days.
For 10 days.
Reported back to Camp Lejeune, with Courthouse Bay in Camp Lejeune, where we went.
Now, when you came back here, I guess all your friends were already in the service, most of them, huh?
Everybody's gone.
So,
had all the girls.
Well, that's good.
Had plenty of girlfriends while I was here.
Okay, so then you went, after your leave, then you went where?
A place called Courthouse Bay. It's on the river, that new river, Camp Lejeune.
Camp Lejeune, okay. And what were your what was your assignment down there then?
Well, that base we went to was a barrage balloon base, but they'd done give it up. They wasn't going to do that no more. They're just beginning the amphibian tractors. And they had just got in what the old alligators, the first one they got in, you know. Uh-huh. And so I went to, we was in training there for 6 months on those things.
Uh-huh.
They trained us as mechanics and operators, machine gunners, and every facet of the what you had to do to operate an amphibian tractor and what they were for.
Right. So was this what you had been assigned to do then, to operate an amphibian
tractor?
Yeah,
I had told them when the four went in I wanted to be a bulldozer operator, and when they interviewed me after boot camp, they said, we don't have any engineers in the Marines, don't have bulldozers, but we got something real close to it. It's a tractor, and you drive it like a bulldozer, but it goes in the water too. Uh-huh. Sound like fun, so I said, yeah, I'll take it.
Okay.
So I volunteered.
That was your first mistake, to volunteer. Anyway, so they assigned you to this particular duty. Now, is that what you did down, trained in this particular piece of equipment?
We trained there for 6 months on the amphibian tractors. And
did it take 6 months to learn how to really
At this time in the war, World War II, was when they first started accepting blacks in the military service.
Okay.
And the Marine Corps at that time had one battalion of blacks that I didn't know about until we got there, until we got to Camp Lejeune.
Uh-huh.
And they were stevedores.
Uh-huh.
And it was our job to train them how to get to and from the ship to shore with the cargo so they could load it and unload it. And it was our job to take haul the cargo ashore. We drove the Amtrak and hauled it ashore.
Uh-huh.
And they rode with us and unloaded it and reloaded the Amtrak or something else and go back to the ship. That's training, you know. We did that for 6-8 weeks, and we lived and camped with this black battalion for the whole week.
Uh-huh.
And I met some of the smartest people I've ever met in my life there. They by law, my understanding was that they couldn't have over 3 stripes. All the officers were second lieutenants and first lieutenants, and they was, I heard by the grapevine that they was guys that screwed up somewhere else and got black shanghaied to this outfit.
Mm. And they're all white, I take it.
They're all white. All the officers were white. But they had these black men that was qualified to be a general, as buck sergeant high as he could go.
Mm.
And I know one or two of those guys now. I met them at the VA hospital in the last 10 years and talked to them. And they remembered how it was.
Okay, so you were with this group then for your entire training period?
We only stayed with this battalion about 6 weeks.
Okay.
But we was out in boondocks doing all this, on the beach, camping, bivouacking, and learning how to live without, you know, learn how to live off of K rations. And
right.
There's another thing that happened down there an awful lot that's no secret anymore, too, that most Americans didn't know it. If they had, they'd have been in a hell of a lot worse shape than they were out of the snipers in Washington a while back. There's Germans coming ashore down there practically every night from submarines.
Mm-hmm.
And when hardly a night passed, we didn't get one or two.
Is that right?
Somebody on that Marine base would get one or two every night, it seemed to me like. Maybe not every night, but every week or two, we'd pick up 2 or 3. I wasn't involved in doing this, but yeah. I knew it was done. I know some guys that did do it.
Hmm. So they'd come ashore there. It sounds like one of the worst places in the world to come ashore.
Well, they didn't know they was coming into Marine Base, I'm sure.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's a big place.
Yeah, right.
A lot of boondocks down there.
Yeah. So so basically your time then at Camp Lejeune was training and then practical experience in operating this
right,
piece
yeah.
of equipment then, huh?
Did
you have any idea, I mean, were you, at this time, did you, and I guess this was late 42, I assume, is that correct?
I think so.
Late 42. Did you have any good feel for what was happening in the war around the world? Did you feel informed as to what was going on through your,
well,
I guess you had a Post newspaper, didn't you, and the Stars and Stripes or whatever?
I don't recall a newspaper we had. Stars and Stripes was Army. Marine Corps didn't have anything, as I know of. And it was all strictly business, training and nothing else there.
Mm-hmm.
And when we graduated down there, we had a very special guest.
Mm-hmm.
He was Secretary of the Navy, Knox.
Yeah, Frank Knox, right.
And Well, and we was all dressed in our finest combat wear, you know, because mm-hmm. we understood he's going to ride one of our Amtraks across the river.
Oh.
And I don't know how and why they picked my tractor, but he rode across the river on my Amtrak. I drove the tractor, and he stood up in the bay behind me.
Mm-hmm.
And I was scared to death.
You didn't want to screw up at that time, did you?
They built him a set of steps to climb up to get on the tractor with. Yeah. And when I got back, I had to sit there, and he made me run over a tree. He said, I want you to go over that tree. So I heard they'd knock them down. I run over the tree, and it just rode it down, went on over it.
Really? How big a tree would that knock
maybe
down?
4 to 6 inches in diameter, uh-huh. pine tree in the sand.
Yeah,
you know?
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And we got back over, he shook hands with him and said, good ride.
Well, that was, he's quite a famous individual, I must say, Frank Knox.
I did get a chance to meet him for a second.
Right. Okay, so then you graduated, right?
Yeah.
Sometime in, would that be late 42 or early 43? What would that be?
Well, I actually had a birthday in September the 3rd, and I had five sisters, and they all got together and picked me up a big old bag of stuff and sent it to me.
Uh-huh.
And we shipped out before I got it.
So, oh, really? Okay, so that is late 42, but it was...
Now, this, keep this in mind, it's late 42 that they, right. they shipped me this bag of
right.
birthday presents.
Uh-huh. Okay, and then you shipped out there before it arrived. Is that the idea?
Yeah, we caught a train, went to San Diego.
I assume it never caught up with you?
The mail caught up with me in August the next year.
Oh, no. That package is they had mailed a year earlier.
That package.
For heaven's sake.
It was mailed in August, and I got it in August.
So it took almost a year to, well, virtually a year then, to catch up with you, huh?
Well, from the time that I left in October, and I left, I'll get it right in a minute.
Camp Lejeune?
I left Camp Lejeune in October and rode a train out to San Diego
mm-hmm.
and went to Long Beach
mm-hmm.
and stayed there in a tent camp until we went overseas. We shipped out on December 31st.
Tell me about your train ride out there. What was a pretty busy, active train? I do. I want to hear it. I want to hear what happened
to
you.
It's the worst one in the world, I know. It was 120 some people, and I was the second highest ranked person on the board on the train. I was PFC. We had one corporal in charge of it, and okay. I was his assistant.
Yeah.
We got on that train in Wilmington. We didn't know. They didn't tell us where we were going, you know.
Yeah,
we went south. That's all we knew.
Yeah.
Somebody said, we're going to Florida. Someone said, no, we're going to New Orleans. And well, we went through Atlanta, and we turned west, I think, and went west. Next thing I know, we're out in the deserts. We got out in Arizona somewhere about the fourth day, 5 days on that train, 5 days and nights on that train. Now, when we left, we had two empty boxcars. They had set up a row of bunks, a row of bunks on each side of that car,
mm-hmm.
and had half of the men in one boxcar and the other half in another one. I call them boxcar, but these old converted coaches, but didn't have no seats in them, had beds, bunks.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Army bunks.
Yeah.
And we had two bathrooms, one in each car. And we packed our sea bags up in one of those and closed it up. And I remember every time that train stopped, we had to eat at a railroad station. And all we had to eat the time we left here, we got there, was chicken or eggs, one or the other. And we had no other kind of meat, no other kind of breakfast, just chicken. Twice a day and eggs for breakfast.
You never had any Spam?
No Spam. Hadn't been invented then, I don't think. We got back to, we were going through Arizona, I think, and was going to come into California the next day or next night. Every man on that train got the GIs. And Seabags had one of the bathrooms closed up. All I can tell you is when that train pulled into that station in Los Angeles, Everybody said that's the stinkingest train ever landed there.
I'm sure it was.
A sick bunch of boys, I'll tell you what.
What else? Were there other troops on this train other than
just
you
us?
Guys? Just you guys?
Just these two carloads and all.
And the rest was like
we was on a freight train.
Freight train, yeah.
Freight train pulling us.
Yeah, okay. So it was freight except for your two cars. Okay, so you got into San Diego then, and what happened to you?
Well, they put us on Army trucks, a Marine vehicle, and carried us down to Long Beach, Tent City down there. Where
okay. And so you lived out of a tent. How many were in a tent? I mean, how big a tent did you have?
Four to six. And it was in a mud hole on a hillside right off the beach. And there was Fourth Marine Division was forming at that time. They were just beginning to form the Fourth Marine Division, and we didn't know it at that time. We was going to be a part of it. And they did form at Camp Pendleton, which is a few miles away from there, and this is a part of Camp Pendleton too. And so they had a company called the 10th Amphibian Tractor Battalion, and they sent us all down to San Diego to be shipped out. We went down there, and there was a brand new LSD landing ship dock number 4 out there. I found out later the official name for that ship was the USS Argus. And the amphibian tractors that we was going to take over, they had learned that they needed armor plate put on, but they wasn't thick enough to stop a 25 caliber bullet.
Really? 25 caliber, huh?
And that's what the Japs were hitting those. We was after Tarawa, and the Amtrak carried those people in on Tarawa. We lost 2/3 of our tractors with 25 calibers because it penetrated the metal and stopped the tractors. So they're putting a half-inch armor plate on, added on to our Amtrak before we went over. And they covered up the windshields and left a slit about 2 inches, about 3 inches long, about an inch wide for the driver and the radio operator to look out. And they got everything, everybody left except the LSD-4. All the rest of the ships sailed. And they told us we had to go by ourselves. We was 2 weeks behind the rest of the guys. And nobody had any idea where we was going.
Why were you 2 weeks behind?
Pulled out 2 weeks ahead of us. And so...
No particular reason. I mean, you just...
We was putting the armor plate on the Amtraks.
Oh, okay. I see. That delayed
They
you.
Couldn't leave until we got armor plate put on all the Amtraks.
Okay.
Then we had to put them in the water and float them into this vehicle, into this ship.
Right.
And the LSTs, they drive them in, but these had to float them in.
I see.
Well, we caught up with them in the Hawaiian Islands. In fact, I think they stayed, the ones that went out ahead of us, they stayed in Pearl Harbor there for Honolulu for 2 or 3 days.
Now, were you part of a convoy when you went over, or were you literally
we were
by
behind
yourself?
The convoy. We were literally two or three weeks behind the convoy.
So there was no other convoy that you were with? You
lone
were just
ship.
By yourself? Pretty risky operation.
It seemed like it to us.
Well, the Japanese subs were still pretty active at that time.
I don't know how close it is getting to the coast in California, but we were from California to Hawaii.
Yeah,
alone.
I mean, you know they were out there.
We might have had a submarine out there we didn't know about. I don't know.
Right. But anyway, you arrived safely in
Pearl Harbor. We arrived safely there. But the rest of them was pulling out when we got there, so they wouldn't let us go ashore. And they still didn't know where it was going. Well, next stop was the Marshall Islands.
What was your voyage like from the U.S. out to Pearl Harbor on a ship of that kind? Did you have decent weather, or was it
rough? We had beautiful weather, and it was just gorgeous the whole time. It was a wonderful ship ride, if it hadn't been for the purpose of it.
Yeah, right. But at least you...
Frank Sinatra had just became the number one singer in the world, and him, Bing Crosby, was having a fight with who's number one, and we had to sit up and listen to them a day and night wide open.
So when you were traveling on this LSD-4, then to Pearl Harbor, then you did have some recreation, you might say. At least you had a radio anyway. You could listen to what was going on in the U.S. and listen to music and so forth. Is that fair to say?
Well, so many people on that ship, it wasn't much to do. We just we used to keep our gear clean, and they called us all together, two or three times a day, and talked. And
what'd they talk about?
And done a little more schoolwork, book work, just studying the principles of what we had to do, but didn't know where we was going.
Right.
But I'm sure the officers knew something about what we was going to do, and so they were smart enough to tell us some things we had to look out for.
Now, aboard this LSD, did you have just a little bunk of some kind, or what did you sleep in?
Just on the starboard side and the port side. It's like two walls of tanks, and inside the walls had bunks.
So you had a good galley, and so that means your food was pretty good.
We had very good food, and they had one of our guys working in the kitchen, and so he's especially good to us.
Mm-hmm.
We got all beans we wanted for breakfast.
Sounds like you had a lot of beans.
We had a lot of beans, man, on them Navy ships.
How did you pass the time? Of course, you went to school, you said, a little bit, but did you?
Playing poker with matchsticks, matches, anything we could get a hold of to use and play some money. We didn't have any money.
No money. Oh, that brings up a point. How did you get paid during this time? Never got paid, okay.
I never got paid, as well as didn't get any mail.
For how long didn't you get paid? A year?
Yeah.
Well, I'll be. That's the first I've heard of that situation.
Well, you'll find out why in a little bit.
Okay. All right.
The reason for it.
Okay, so anyway, your trip over there you had some food and you had fairly good weather. And when you got to Pearl Harbor, then you didn't actually go ashore then? You took right off? Is that the idea with the rest of the convoy?
We was there maybe. We weren't even tied up. We was anchored off the coast there for waiting for them to get ready to leave for about a half a day.
Uh-huh.
And they pulled out and we went with them.
And then you caught up and were part of the group again. Now, you had these pieces of equipment down in the hold of this LSD. How many let me backtrack. How many pieces of equipment would you have on this LSD, just roughly?
We had a whole company of Marines on there with about 20, 24 amphibian tractors and five men for each tractor.
Okay. LSD is a little bigger than I recollected, I guess.
And, well, you had they had built some kind of, they put food under the, had lumber on top of food.
Uh-huh.
Somewhere or another, I don't know how they done that. And we discovered that. And we dug some of that, we dug through some of that lumber and found this food, gallon cans of fruit cocktail, gallon cans of.
So you found some food.
Wieners.
But so they were trying to keep that little secret, huh?
This wasn't too smart, though. In these amphibian tractors, the engine was in the rear, and the final drive was in the front. Uh-huh. The driver was set in the front.
Yeah.
There was a lot of empty space down in there. It didn't dawn on us it was to keep us afloat. A lot of the guys were getting that food and filling it, said, we'll go ashore here and we'll have something to eat.
Uh-huh.
So some of them like the sunk tractors overloading them with food.
Oh, yes, yeah. I see the
point.
But at
the Marshall Islands, we lost a lot of tractors before we got to the beach.
Yeah. Okay, so you went to the Marshall Islands. Now, what did you know? Did you know you were going to the Marshall Islands at that point?
They told us the night before we landed at daylight the next morning.
Okay, what island, specific island, were you headed toward?
Roy and Namur.
Okay.
Nobody ever heard of them. But Namur was the air base, and Roy was where all the Japs was at. The whole island wasn't big as 10 ball fields. It's on a round a volcano edge or something, had a string all the way around, little islands.
Yeah. So you approached this island. right? You're coming up to this.
We had to get inside of the atoll, you know, get inside of the, what you might say, the crater of the, where the water was smooth. And then we went ashore from the inside.
Now, what was your purpose right then? What were you doing from a military standpoint? What were you actually hoping to accomplish right then?
We're going to take that island.
Okay.
At any cost, we're going to take it.
Okay, so this is an invasion of that island then, basically.
This turned out to be the longest ship to shore invasion that's ever been pulled off in the world, as far as I know.
Ship to shore. Now, did you
We boarded ship in San Diego with a combat gear.
Uh huh.
And we got off in Marshall Islands to meet the enemy.
Yeah.
With the gear we brought from San Diego.
So
we didn't get off a ship the whole trip.
Specifically going there for an invasion.
Right.
Now, in this convoy that you were with, what did you have? Battleships, cruisers? What?
Everything. When we left Honolulu, as far as you could see, there was an American ship anywhere you wanted to look.
Did you have some carriers with you, too?
Sure we did. I don't recall one that I could name, but I'm sure we had carriers. I know we had cruisers, battleships, and destroyers.
Okay, so when you approached these islands, then what did the battleships and cruisers? What were they doing?
Well, the battleships pulled out and left us, and they went on ahead of us, and they laid off those islands a few miles and throwed enough shells in there to kill everything alive for 100 miles, I thought. I said, my goodness, we don't have a problem at all. We're going to show nobody to be there.
How about, did you have any air support at all? Were there any planes flying?
We had Corsairs and something else, TBMs, TBYs.
Uh-huh. Yeah. So softening up all these were softening up this island.
We understood that they bombed them for weeks before we landed.
Okay, then, so they were doing that before you ever got there.
And then they done it right up until we got there.
Uh-huh.
And then we had small planes going in strafing as we was going in over our heads.
Okay, so your ship was LSD-4 was laying offshore there, or did you get into the
It was laying offshore. It was supposed to went through the pass and went inside, but they didn't for some reason or another, and they let us off 5 miles before we got to the shore, and we lost a lot of Amtrak because we ran out of fuel.
Did any ships get inside this atoll there?
Not the first day.
Okay, so you're all laying offshore then.
Yeah.
And now tell me what that was like. Now you're there. What time of day was this, for example?
Getting daylight and raining.
It was early and raining.
Heavy swells in the water, at least 30 foot high.
Now, what preparation did they give you before they said, hey, we're going to be invading this island? You know, what did they tell you about that?
Well, our job was to drive those Amtraks to the beach, get our men ashore, and get back to the ship to get some more men. Our job was to protect our craft.
Now, these Amtraks would carry how many troops?
We carried, I believe, two squads on each one.
And
then we had a five-man crew.
A squad is like 20 guys in two squads?
Yeah. We had a five-man crew. We had a crew chief and a radio operator and a .230 caliber machine gun operator and a .50 caliber machine gun aboard these things. And We went in firing everything we had.
Now, what was your specific job?
Get these men ashore alive.
What did you do, though, aboard this vessel?
I was a crew chief.
You were the crew chief. Okay.
I was to make sure that the rest of the guys were doing their job.
Right, now, you're out there, and it's early in the morning. What did they
also on a 30 caliber machine gun.
Okay. What did they tell you the night before? Because you obviously would have been there, I guess, the night before, right, at least.
Well, they told us it wasn't going to be easy. Told us there was 3,500 Japs on that island.
Okay, when did they pull you together and say, this is why you guys are here? You know, when did you learn?
The night before.
The night before, okay. So this is a surprise to you then, the night before?
No, it wasn't a surprise. I knew it was coming. I didn't know when.
You just didn't know when, though. But the night before, though, when they said, hey, guys, we're taking this island, you had no inkling of that, though, did you, before then?
No, I didn't know what island's going to be until then. I knew it was going to be somewhere.
Okay. And so what did your superior officer or enlisted man that you reported to tell you? What did they tell you?
You mean after it's over or before?
No, before you went in. What did they tell you?
Oh, they just told us that it's going to be rough. Some of you not coming back.
Now, did you have a map?
We had a map.
That said, hey, this is where you're supposed to go.
They had a map. They showed it to us.
Were you a PFC then? Or were you
PFC.
Okay, Private Griffith, then this is where you're supposed to go on this map?
Yeah, we had maps. We had like Red Beach, Blue Beach, and Green Beach.
Okay.
And it's X amount of crack was supposed to be in the first wave in Blue Beach and X amount in this one.
This is an editor's note. End of tape A, side one. The interview continues on tape A, side two.
So do you remember, not important, but do you remember which beach that you were heading toward?
I didn't know which one it was until after the campaign was over where I landed, but I landed at the right place. I was in Namoa.
Okay. Now, let me ask you again. Now, when they told you, you know, this is what you have to do, Private Griffith, take these men, this piece of equipment with these 20-some men into this beach, what did they tell you you could expect, and what kind of instructions did you get on how you're supposed to handle this?
They told us we may be parked, may pull up in front of a pill box, would have machine guns or big weapons, and to get out of the way if you could.
Mm-hmm.
But get your men to the beach if you can. And yeah. So they was trained to half of them jump off one side of the Amtrak and half the other side. This thing didn't let down in the front and rear like it do today.
Yeah.
And
now how close were you to get to the beach?
Oh, it was 5, 6, 7 miles, something like that.
Now how close were you to take your piece of equipment there to the beach? How close did you actually get on the beach?
I got on the beach.
You didn't jump off before you got on?
I didn't.
The guys.
The crew didn't jump off. We stayed with
it. I meant the men you were carrying.
Well, I got them on the beach and they jumped off.
Okay. And so you actually got up on the beach then, huh?
Most of them got killed before they got 100 yards in. And the second time I came in.
Now, what happened to your.
I went back for another load.
Now, what happened? Now, you must have been taking a lot of fire then.
We were taking fire, but I don't know. I don't know why we didn't get shot out, but we didn't. But most of our Amtrak made more than one trip.
Mm-hmm.
The drivers could get away sometimes, but the second time I came back with my second load, live Japs met us in the water up to the waist trying to throwing knives at us, throwing rocks at us.
You're kidding. They had waded out into the water.
We'd knock them off of the Amtrak with boat hooks.
Is that right? How many were, were there a lot of them?
Well, four or five at one time. Looked like teenage kids coming out, going to swim out and take a ride with us or something. Yeah. But well, that's a Jap. Knock him in the head with a boat hook. Let him go.
Now, they were firing their weapons or what were they
doing?
They
didn't have weapons. They'd run out of the hole without the weapons to save a butt, I guess.
We're talking about
put flamethrowers and everything else and all them things. In 2 days there.
Well, I'm just curious, why do you think they ran toward your...
Nowhere else to go.
They couldn't go back?
They could go for the water, you know, and go for the water. Maybe got scorched or something, I don't know.
They couldn't retreat back anywhere, huh?
No place to go.
Oh, it was a pretty thin area.
We already had hundreds of Marines up there.
Okay.
Couldn't go back up that way.
So they had passed their
this
particular...
This is some Japs that they had run over, I guess.
I see, yeah, okay. So they were trying to get, for whatever reason...
We didn't want to... We were very, very protective of Amtraks because if we lost them, we automatically joined the infantry.
Oh, okay.
So we made every effort to get our Amtrak back to the ship.
Now, you were getting a few zingers on your... dings on your... on your Amtrak, weren't you, from these shells flying around?
Yeah, that armor plate we put on paid off.
Yeah, should say. And so far as you know, then, the two trips that you, or maybe you made more, I don't know, but at least the two trips you made, your men got off safely, even though they might have been shot later on.
Well, what we did there, we probably had 400 tractors or more there with all the ships and the vehicles we had. Most of these Amtraks run day and night for 6 days. When we got the troops all in, then we brought supplies in.
I see.
And we brought the food first, then we brought ammunition first. we supplied the ammunition first, and then we brought the food, and then we brought water at all times, you know. And,
So you basically were going back and forth.
Back and forth.
Just all the time.
And we had to drive across at a toll, backwards and forward. Now, I think it was the fourth, maybe fifth or sixth day, somewhere along there. I was coming back from a beach, going to the ship, across this huge atoll, you know, where the water was smooth.
Yeah.
Picked up a Marine floating in the water. He'd been, apparently been in there all day. In fact, we pulled him aboard, and when we got him out of the water, he turned blue and his teeth chattered. And so we didn't have any clothes with us to put on him or anything, so I took mine off and put on him. I took my pants off, my jacket both, and wrapped him up. We took him to the nearest hospital ship we could, a ship that had a sick bay, wasn't a real hospital ship. And we left him there, and you'll hear more about him later.
Okay. Don't forget.
I'll tell you when it was we left him there. It was, now I can't tell you. It's April the 25th, I think, April 24th, somewhere along there.
Okay, it's 1943 then, I think.
Yeah, 1943.
Okay, so how long did this, you kept going back and forth and for 6 days or more, you said, I think?
It was 6 days for me now. The night that I left that boy aboard that ship, we were invited to pull up beside of a merchant marine ship and spend the night.
Was this the first decent night's sleep?
This was the only one I got at Marshall Islands.
Really?
And
other than that, you were sleeping at your post or whatever.
I know. We slept in the tract, and there was always one or two of us on watch.
Yeah.
But we went aboard a merchant marine ship. They invited us aboard to eat. They cooked steaks for us, and they put us to bed and gave us a bunk and said, if anything happens, we'll take care of you. And I woke up about 5 o'clock the next morning. This ship was out in the middle of the Pacific Ocean. The captain got orders to sail about 2 o'clock in the morning.
Ooh.
And he wouldn't cut us loose and let us float back to the island. He said if he did, own men might kill us. So he carried us with him.
What do you mean your own men might kill you?
They see this Amtrak floating back in the beach in the night, you know, that we'd probably shoot it.
Oh, I see what you mean, yeah.
Making no noise.
The wrong time in the wrong place, huh?
So he said to save us from getting killed going back to the beach, that he had orders to leave, and he had to leave, so he took us with him.
Well, for heaven's sake. So you're in kind of a...
All right, remember I told you to start with, I was in Company C, 10th Amphibian Tractor Battalion.
Yeah.
We stayed aboard this ship for 10 days and stopped at Pearl Harbor. They put us off a ship, me and four other guys. Told us to report that Marine barracks away. We go over there, and he tried to accuse us of deserting.
Yeah.
We told him he was at Marshall Island. He said, well, you couldn't have got here unless you deserted. It was kind of hectic there for a while, because we didn't know what he was going to do. Was he going to lock us up or keep us or what?
For heaven's sake.
But our ride had done left. We were there.
Well, surely the captain of that ship could confirm what...
We didn't know who he was. It's a merchant ship.
Yeah.
Civilians. And,
oh, okay.
But anyhow, he told us we could stay. He was going to find out something about us. And so we stayed there 10 days, maybe 15. And while we were there, they issued us a new khaki uniform and... a scarf and everything, and gave us liberty in Honolulu, and let us sign an SMR for $10, special money requisition. So I had $10 and liberty.
That's the first money you'd gotten, I guess. Huh?
Yeah, first money I'd gotten
for a long time.
So about 10 or 15 days later, from the time we arrived there, a ship came by, and they told us we were going to put butts aboard it, and we're going to send us back to Marshall Islands.
Oh, is this
so
a
that's what happened.
Navy vessel, I take it?
Yeah. They took us back to Marshall Islands and pulled out a gurney boat of some kind off the ship, put us in it, and a coxswain carried us to the beach. A group of Marines right over there behind them coconut trees said, y'all just report to them over and tell them we put you off here. Five of us. We walk up on these guys, you know, this Marines. I'd never seen any of them before. It was Company A, 10th Amphibian Tractor Battalion, and I'm from Company C. Well, talked to the sergeant and asked him, I told him who we were and how we got there. He gave me a mean look. He said, you expect me to believe it, I reckon. Well, I got nothing else to tell you. You have to believe me, I guess. Well, make a long story short, this was Company A, 10th Amphibian Track Battalion, and they didn't tell me that they was lost.
They're lost.
I knew I was lost from my company, but when I joined up with them, I joined up with a whole company of Marines that was lost from the whole battalion, a whole division.
When you say lost, what do you mean lost? They were just apart from the where they ought to be, and they just...
The 4th Marine Division...
They don't know where they are?
4th Marine Division left Company A, 10th Amphibian Tractor Battalion on the Marshall Islands on purpose to transport the 22nd and 23rd Marines to and from all the islands in the island that we didn't land on.
Okay.
To secure the whole group.
Right.
It's hundreds of them.
Uh-huh.
And when they sent for the 22nd and 23rd Marines to pick them up, they didn't think to pick up the, they didn't send enough equipment to pick up the amphibian tractor people. So they told them, said, you just stay here and we'll send somebody back after you.
Okay.
Well, they stayed there for 6 more weeks and nobody came back after them. And to this day, nobody come back after them.
And so you were there with them?
So I'm with them, but I didn't know all this at that time. I learned this after I got out of service. After we started having reunions when I learned it. Well, it's kind of hard to understand the whole.
Now, what island is this? Is this Nomura?
This is at Marshall Islands.
Yeah,
this is the second time I'd been there. You know,
yeah.
First time I was in combat. Second time I'm trying to find my outfit, and I found A Company instead of C Company,
yeah.
And I joined them. They let us join them.
Right. Okay.
So the captain told us, got us all together one day, and told us, we got to get out of here. So we said, 4th Marine Division not coming back after us. Says, we're going to have to get on the radio and find a ship that's going somewhere. It'll take us. And so they worked for about 2 or 3 weeks getting the ship to stop. They finally got one to stop. And he said he had enough room on the ship to take them in, but he couldn't take the equipment. We still had 19 amphibian tractors still running. So we left them sitting on the beach, and we all got on this ship, went with it, didn't know where he was going. He didn't know either. He got word after a day or two after his boat going Guadalcanal. And he said he thought that might be where the 4th Marine Division went. Well, we get down to Guadalcanal and it wasn't. 3rd Marine Division was down there. And we still didn't know where the 4th Marine Division was. Now here I am lost from Company C and I'm joined Company A, and Company A is lost from a whole damn division. And we know now that the 4th Marine Division was in Maui, the Hawaiian Islands.
Oh, they were.
Which I was a mile from when I was in Pearl Harbor.
Yeah, right.
But now I'm in Guadalcanal.
Right.
And
now this is well after, I guess, it was taken, or?
Yeah, it was in late... Well, about the middle of the year, I guess, in 43.
Okay.
43, 41, 40. I get my old mixed up.
Yeah, I know. It's hard.
But anyhow,
Guadalcanal was secured at that point.
The island was secured, and there was a lot of army there, bivouacking, being transported one place to another, mm-hmm. just spending the night or something like that. One of them had been occupying some area there for quite a while, and they was about fixing to leave when we got there. And odd thing happened was we set up camp on a place called Maggot Beach. You can guess how it got that name.
Yeah.
And we was next to an army camp. We hadn't been there a week, maybe 2 weeks, till they got orders to leave. And we got orders to leave. This is when the 3rd Marine Division decided they'd pick us up and take us. Mm-hmm. They needed some amphibian tractors because they're getting ready to go to Saipan and Guam, because mm-hmm. we didn't know where this was going, but they said they could use us. So they supplied us with new tractors and all the equipment we needed. And took us with them. Mm-hmm. And fed us, of course. But when we started to leave, we was marching up an old muddy road on Guadalcanal, and right behind a troop of army men, and the last man in the first column on the rear turned around and looked, and he was my first cousin from Woolwine, Virginia. Well, he liked to kill me before it was over with. My lieutenant was walking along beside him, and I told him, I said, I know that guy. I know who that is. That's Tim Kennedy. That's my first cousin. He said, can I break ranks and go up and kick his butt? He said, yeah, go ahead. I got right behind him and started marching real close to him. All of a sudden, I let him have it with my knee. He come around with that rifle butt, and if I had a duck, he'd have killed me. But they let us fall out and let us enjoy our meeting over there for about while we marched another 30 miles, I think, where we were going. But we walked together the whole 30 miles. And I never seen him more during the whole war, and he never seen me after that until we got home.
Is that right?
We met over there. It's strange.
Is he still living just out of here?
He's still living.
Still living.
Bishop Ed Bassett. Uh-huh. And he told me later after I got home that he run a sawmill over there for the Army.
Really?
They captured a British sawmill. Nobody had to know how to run it. So he ran the sawmill over there for the Army and made lumber to put in the tents.
I see. Okay, so you're marching with your cousin, and what happened then?
They loaded us all up on LSTs, the whole 3rd Marine Division shipped out. We didn't know where it was going again, but we knew it was going to combat.
Now you got matched back up with, you're still with the 3rd Marine Division, aren't you?
Now I'm with the Company A 10th Amphibian Tractor Battalion, but they are now they're no longer with the 4th Marine Division. They are attached to the 3rd Marine Division.
Okay, all right.
And so I'm attached to them.
So you're legal now, I guess,
I guess, but now all the guys in Company A, 10th Amphibian Tractor Battalion, except me and the 4 guys that are with me, got paid on Guadalcanal.
Uh-huh.
Their records caught up with them there.
I see.
And then I got paid on Guam in August. But that's where we went when we left Guadalcanal. We went to Saipan and then to...
What is your recollection of Guadalcanal as you were thinking about what it looked like and, I guess you maybe saw some natives, people there and so forth. Did you have any feel for what that place was like after going through the brutal battles?
First encounter with real island people, and I was amazed at this. I don't know what they were called. I don't remember what they called the people on Guadalcanal, but they had every kind of disease that could be imagined, I guess, and one was elephantitis.
Oh yeah. Mm-hmm. Heard of that.
And
never seen it.
Somebody told us one time that the Red Cross was up there somewhere serving ice cream. Mm-hmm. So a couple of us on Sundays, we were going to hitchhike the army traffic up and down the highway, old muddy roads all, see if we could get up there and get us some ice cream. Mm-hmm. And caught a ride on a 6x6, open top, just one guy driving, he stopped. And he had this, we called them gooks, I don't know why, that's what everybody called them, what Marines called them, native gooks. Had this gook sitting up in a front seat with him, and he said, crawl on the back and I'll take you up there. And we crawled on the back, and he went on about another mile up the road and stopped and let this gook off, and he reached down between his legs, picked this basket up and set it out on the ground, and thanked him for the ride somewhere or another with his hands. And when he set it down, that's the first time I realized that wasn't a bag of old dried up walnuts. It's part of his body.
Really?
Came from between his legs.
Oh, for heaven's sake.
He carried it in a basket.
Oh, my word.
The driver told me that, and he said, plenty of them around here like that. He said, don't have nothing to do with them, said, you might catch it.
Boy, oh boy.
Scary.
Scary is right. And the condition of the island was, a lot of devastation, I'm sure.
And
a lot of bomb craters.
I didn't meet anybody, I don't think, at didn't have malaria one time or another down there. Mm-hmm. Everybody had it. I had it. Later on I got dengue fever too.
Yeah.
But the malaria didn't bother me as bad as dengue fever did.
You know, you really ache from that.
The worst thing I got in Guadalcanal, and I still got it, I got jungle rot. And I would swear it's a live creature of some kind that crawls around on your body the way it acts. And I know two or three other guys got it too, but the VA still denies it. They say, nah, it's just imagination.
Hmm. Well, not to delve into it, but what makes you think you have jungle rot?
It's in my ears.
Uh-huh.
I take constant medication daily to keep it cleaned out, and when I do, I get a sore spot behind my ears.
Uh-huh. So you figure it's from that, those days, huh?
I've been doing it ever since I got back.
Yeah. Okay, so then you went to Guam, you say, from Guadalcanal?
We stayed aboard this ship, but I guess it's the longest ship ride I've ever been on. We was aboard that ship 62 days from Guadalcanal to an LST with a 6-second roll.
Oh, you mean it rolled every 6 seconds?
Every 6 seconds. It
oh, my word. Is that something?
I never had a problem with it.
Yeah.
A lot of people did.
Sounds like an uncomfortable ride.
We went to Saipan first, and I don't remember the exact date of that, but it was, I guess it was in January, 43, I guess. 43, 44.
That would have been 44, probably.
I don't remember. No, I think the whole thing is in 43.
Really? Okay.
43. I guess it was 44.
Saipan was attacked in 44.
Well, we was on standby in Saipan for almost 30 days.
Is this the original invasion or what?
The original plans were at the 4th Marine Division would hit Saipan today, and tomorrow the 3rd Marine Division would hit Guam. And I'm supposed to be in the 4th Marine Division, but I got lost from them, so now I'm in the 3rd Marine Division. I'm going to hit Guam.
Right.
I didn't know that at the time either.
Mm-hmm.
But it didn't happen that way because the Japs run the Marines off of the island up at Saipan the first two or three days. And so we pulled a fake landing. We went around the backside of the island and started unloading.
Of Saipan, you're talking about?
Yeah.
Okay.
We went around and the Japs was fighting the Marines in the mountains on Saipan, saw us coming on the other side, and they run back to meet us. We hightailed it back to ships and let them go, and then the Marines on the island run them off in the ocean.
That's
the way they won that war.
Yeah.
It's fake landing.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's interesting.
Then we had to go back to Aniwetok and meet supply ships. See, we'd overstayed we're supposed to be in combat.
So in Saipan, you were only involved in this fake landing?
I was only involved in that fake invasion.
I see. Okay.
The whole fleet that I was with was involved.
Did you take much fire out there in that fake invasion?
None. They had nothing to reach us out there.
Okay.
And nobody went ashore from our
group. Nobody actually went ashore.
Nobody actually went ashore. Mm-hmm. We just made it look like we're coming ashore.
Yeah.
So they started moving equipment to meet us.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And that's when they hit them hard and
on
ran
the
over.
Side. Yeah.
I had a brother there in the Army.
Hmm.
But then we went back to Aniwetok and anchored there and met supply ships and resupplied, got new ammunition, new food, new water, new everything.
Mm-hmm.
And got ready then went back to Guam and made the invasion.
Okay.
And
now, did you know you were going to Guam?
We knew we were going to Guam. We knew it from as soon as we knew the other place was Saipan, we'd already been told we're going to Guam tomorrow.
Oh, okay.
And then they were told we're going to delay it for a little while.
Mm-hmm. Well, they did the fake.
And they told us why.
Yeah.
They was having a problem.
Okay, so you headed toward Guam. And how long a voyage was that?
Well, Guam's a good-sized island. It's always been American territory, but the Japs took it away from us.
How long did it take you to get to Guam?
A couple of days.
Oh, that close, okay.
2 days, two nights, I think, was there. But we had different landing places there, and we landed in southern part of the island, a city called Agate. Mm-hmm. I call Agate Bay. And the other guys landed up north where it was, where Agana was at, which was the capital city. It was the mm-hmm. biggest city in a city on the island. And we had five beaches down there to land on, I think, red, white, blue, green, and yellow. And for some unknown reason or another, I guess it was the tide or the way the wind blowed or whatever, everybody was off at least one beach. Hmm. And like I was in Blue Beach. I was supposed to come in at a certain place, but I missed that place by like 600 feet. Everybody went to the right. Mm-hmm. And there was one gun in a cliff there. I've forgotten the size of one big gun Japs had up there. And he got 12 of our amphibian tractors coming in.
Mm. Just direct hits, huh?
Direct hits, and the round that went through the amp track, the concussion killed everybody aboard. Because I had to be in a work party to get them bodies out 3 days later. They didn't die from a gunshot wound, they died from concussion. Most of them did.
Now, were most of those a ways out where they were sunk?
Close in, already on the tracks was already on the ground.
Oh, they were like a stationary target, huh?
And
pretty much.
The only reason they didn't get me, I didn't come in where I was supposed to. Came in to the right and made my landing where I was supposed to, and they couldn't lower the barrel enough to get me and my platoon.
I see.
We went under the gunfire.
I see.
And we made it, I don't know, like it was planned that way somehow. Yeah. That I didn't plan it.
Now you're, so you were still crew chief on this,
yeah.
What, amphibious tractor?
Amphibian tractor,
yeah. So you're still crew chief and you're bringing about 25 men in on that particular
yeah.
vessel. Now, on the invasion of Guam, did you kind of get organized the night before with all your ships and everything out there? And then what did they tell you the night before? I mean,
well, they gave us a whole
what
plan.
What kind of instructions
now,
did you get?
This place had a lot of land and a lot of mountains and good mm-hmm. dry land that you could travel on. Mm-hmm. And they warned us about minefields and all the other obstacles. Mm-hmm. And we had a briefing aboard ship the night before we went ashore, and this colonel came out and told us that, he said, for every crew chief that gets his men ashore, said, see me on Red Beach, and I'll personally shake your hand and give you a bottle of whiskey. Who had seen a bottle of whiskey in over a year?
Yeah. Where'd he get it?
Yeah,
yeah, that's what I wonder.
Well,
he had it.
Anyhow, I'm one of them that made it, and I went down there and I shook his hand, and he handed me a little miniature bottle of whiskey.
Like on the airlines, huh?
And I do five of us.
Yeah.
Hard five of us split that up.
So when you were coming in, what was the ride like coming in from your LSD?
We didn't take any fire, but we saw the amp track around us taking fire. My amp track didn't take any fire, and I don't know why. I had the lead track, the platoon leader was on my amp track, and we were sort of in a V-shape, and I'm on the point. Mm-hmm. But the guys on the side of it, they took some fire, and we lost two tractors on the left of me that got this gun caught them.
Now, before you left your LSD, what...
Now, here we was on LST.
LST, excuse me. Before you left your LST, what routine did they go through? Did they gather all the fellows up and talk to them about anything, or did they have a chaplain there to pray with them, or what did they do?
We had a Protestant priest, a Protestant and a Catholic priest there,
uh-huh.
and aboard ship. Navy, of course,
yeah.
And they they told us what had already happened on Saipan, and we could look for it to be worse on Guam. Mm-hmm. But I don't think that turned out to be true. I don't think it's quite as bad on Guam as it was Saipan. Mm-hmm. Of course, I can't say for sure because I wasn't on Saipan.
Yeah, right. But, so what were the men doing and talking about? What were you talking about with your guys that you were with?
I was talking about, I wonder if I should write a letter and tell somebody that I might not be coming back. But it didn't seem to hurt too bad if we didn't, you know, because we knew we had a job to do and we had to do it.
Mm-hmm. Did any of the guys get physically sick that you know of before they, you know, just vomit, toss their cookie?
We had a few on that LST that got physically sick, but it never bothered me. I don't know why. Mm-hmm.
So you got on your amphibious tractor and just loaded up and took off?
It looked a lot safer at Guam than it did at the Marshall Islands because of the weather. It was a pretty day at Guam. Sun was shining. It was hot. And you could see the ships around you, so many of them you wouldn't believe. And,
yeah.
And the water was calm. And I saw turtles swimming around out there, like 2 or 3 foot abroad across the backs of them. Mm-hmm. That's where they got the world's largest turtles out here. I guess it's running off from the island. I don't know.
I think I would if I were a turtle. Get out of that place.
But we got ashore, and... Then we made a lot of trips. It took a lot less time to get ashore there than it did at the other place because we only had to go like 200 yards out to the ship.
Uh-huh. Oh, the ship was that close in?
It come in real close.
Surprised that those ships didn't take a lot of fire from that gun.
They done knocked out all of the big guns.
Oh, they have?
About all the big guns have been knocked out. Up in the mountains, you know.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
One that could have got them done been knocked out.
Now, did you have a lot of air cover at that time?
We had lots of air cover, lots of it.
So you had carriers and everything out there?
We had planes come in straight for the beach like 5 minutes before we hit the dirt.
Yeah.
But there was about a 500-yard area there that Higgins boats couldn't get in.
Uh-huh.
That's why we used amphibian tractors. You're going over coral reef and water could be 1 inch deep to 10 foot deep in spots between there and the beach.
Yeah.
And no way you'd get over with any kind of boat.
Yeah.
And so that's why the Amtraks were there. It's the only way to get ashore.
Mm-hmm.
And then we had to set up an ammunition dump about a mile from there at the foot of the mountains.
So were you involved bringing ammunition into that?
Yeah, and by 12 o'clock we had all troops ashore.
Mm-hmm.
And by 5 o'clock, we had an ammunition dump a mile up on near the front line. And this is where I said goodbye to my sergeant.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't talk about him much in the early part, but he's the sergeant I reported to when I joined Company A from Company C, and he accused me of. Didn't know whether to believe me or not.
Yeah,
so
right.
He said he told me he's gonna make it hard for me, and he did. He worked me pretty hard, but I done everything he told me to. But it's getting along late in the evening, and I pulled my amp truck up to the ammunition dump and was unloading. Had some guys out there was unloading it, and had a load of ammunition and unloaded it for the front lines and. Things looked pretty quiet around there, so I crawled out of the cab of my tractor and got up on the top of it, sat down on the cab, lit me a cigarette, had a fresh pack of Camels. That's one thing we had plenty of. Now, they didn't let us go. We'd go hungry, but we couldn't go without a cigarette. And Sergeant Parent got out of his tractor and climbed up on the top and got his matches out, and all his matches were wet. And he didn't talk to me much, but he just stepped over on my tractor and sat down beside him and said, "Griff, give me a light." So I struck a match and lit a cigarette. He said, "Been wanting to talk to you for a long time," and says, "I just ain't had a chance to." He said, "I guess right now is good as any time." He said, "I hope you don't take it too hard on me the way I treated you for the last 6 months." I said, "Have I ever said anything to you about it?" And he said, "No." I said, well, I'm not going to take it hard, Dennis. I don't have nothing against you. He said, well, I don't really have anything against you. He said, to tell you the truth, I like you. But said, I just didn't believe you when you first come in the outfit. So I think you're a pretty good Marine, man. And so we shook hands, and he got back in his tractor. He got killed that night.
Is that right?
Hmm. And little stuff like that you'd never forget. But the worst part about it, one of our men killed him.
One of your own men killed him?
But it wasn't his fault.
Oh. Still bad, but...
Parent didn't know the password.
Oh, for heaven's sake.
He didn't give the password.
Oh, boy.
And the boy that shot him got transferred out of the company, and they had a court-martial for him, and they had to clear him off, convict him. And they cleared him. And fined him a dollar so he couldn't be tried again. Mm. Give him a carton of cigarettes, shipped him to another company.
Mm-hmm. Boy, he'll live with that for the rest of his life, too, I guess. What are you going to do?
Well, I've heard through the grapevine that after he got home, he committed suicide.
Yeah, I could believe that would be one of the most devastating things you could do.
Yeah.
Kill a friend.
And
tell me about the passwords. You mentioned that.
The password, funny thing about it, first lieutenant we had was a fellow named George Seifels. He was a graduated from Georgia Tech. Still lives in Brunswick, Georgia. Uh-huh. He's a psychiatrist now. Uh-huh. He was the intelligence officer in my company, and he's the one taught us a password, and we had a different one every night. Uh-huh. And this one time, the password was railroad. And Bill Auld and Slim Bond was on guard duty that night with the Amtrak on the beach. Uh-huh. Kept seeing this guy come walking up the beach. Couldn't tell whether he's Jap or enemy or what. So Bill hollers for the password. Kept coming. Slim Bond pulled a hammer back on his .30 caliber. And then he walked around a coconut tree or something, and Bill sort of got a glimpse of him, and he saw it was George. And Slim was just ready to pull a trigger on him, and Bill put his hand on and says, hold it, Slim. And he gave the password again. He said, my God, Will, is that you? He said, I forgot the damn password. He was a lieutenant. He liked to got it right there.
Oh, I guess he
did. But we did change password every night. And we tried to find...
What point did the new password come into effect? Like at midnight or what?
Yeah, so whatever time we agreed on and when it would start. And we tried to pick words that had double R's in it because Japs had trouble not pronouncing them.
Railroad would be a good one, yeah.
The railroad was a good one.
Uh-huh. So, boy, you better be on the ball. Did you have to write it down to make sure you didn't forget it? I mean,
yeah.
Just think of these guys that didn't know it and they got killed because they're almost
killed. We'd
get
briefed the next morning if there's anybody around to do it. Most of the time it was.
Hmm. So did you physically write it down, or what did you do? The password.
I don't remember. I don't recall writing it down. I just think they hammered it in our head. Don't forget it.
Yeah.
But the man that taught us to have got it.
Yeah, that's really something. Mm. Almost had it himself, huh? Okay, so Guam was... How long did the invasion and the battle last?
The invasion part took... It was over with in 1 to 2 days. But mm-hmm. the supplies kept coming in. Still coming in when I left in December. But the Japs didn't stop fighting. We had Japs in the hills, you know, and this might be a good time to tell you about that guy dropped off in that ship.
Right.
Well, I told you I had a brother in Saipan. Uh-huh. His name is Enos. You may know him. He used to preach here in Eden some, still does once in a while at the Moravian Church.
Uh-huh.
He lives in Hillsville, Virginia now, and In 1993, he come down here and told me this story, but he visited me when I was on Guam. See, Saipan battle was over with, and we're still fighting down at Guam. He came down and found me in combat, in a combat area, and stayed 3 nights with me. Hmm. And while he was there, we killed a Jap in a tent with us that night.
Goodness sake alive.
And one, he's sneaking in trying to find some food, I think, yeah. and guard killed him. And that was,
he wasn't physically in your tent, was it?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Was actually
in a tent that my brother and I was in.
Is that right?
There's 3 or 4 of us in there. And in 1993, he just got out of the VA hospital in Salem and had prostate surgery, I think, and he was getting a little senile, but he asked me, come down here, we got ready to leave. He said, did I ever tell you why I come down to Guam to see you that time? I said, no, you never did. I said, I thought you just come because you found out I was there. No. He said, I found your body on Saipan dead. I said, what are you talking about? He said, well, he said, after we got through, after truce was called up there, my company commander asked me to take him up front, said we was 5 or 6 miles behind the front lines, to see if they'd done any damage. And he said, I got my rifle and got the Jeep, and was sort of like his bodyguard, and we took off. We drove up to the front line and got out. So we walked across this field up on the mountains, top of a mountain up there, and said, dead bodies just everywhere. Mostly Jap, but every once in a while it'd be a Marine, sometimes a soldier. Mm-hmm. And as I stepped over, this Marine had your name on a jacket.
Isn't that something? The one that you'd given the jacket to?
Yep. Mm. We think.
Yeah.
We got no way of proving it, but
yeah. He isn't.
But anyhow, he told his company commander, I believe I found the remains of my brother.
Oh, and, boy.
He said, well, roll him over and get his dog tag out of his mouth. They rolled him over. He fell apart, didn't have no dog tags, nowhere. So he still thought it was me.
Yeah, right.
So company commander got on the horn and trying to find out where I was supposed to be at. Well, he found that the 3rd Marine Division was over there, and I was supposed to be in the 4th, but I wasn't with the 4th. He checked with the 4th, and somebody in the 4th Marine Division told him that I was either missing in action or AWOL. They didn't know which.
<You're> right.
So it turned out they had me missing in action.
Uh-huh.
So anyhow, I was sitting down in my tent one day, and he walked in. And on Guam, he just walked in a tent with me. I said, where'd you come from? He said, well, come down here to see you. So he hung out with me 3 days down there. And it was the first night we had a little scrimmage out behind the area where we was bunked at. And we had foxholes dug in our tents. He didn't. But I can tell you right now, he can dig a foxhole fast as anybody else seen with his hands. He had one before they quit shooting. And then I think it was the next night or the next night one sneaked in our tent and we killed him, or somebody killed him. But he said that's really the closest he'd ever been to combat, because he's in long toms, you know, and he's a long way from combat.
Uh-huh.
But he did. He really thought that was me.
Well, I can see why he would.
I can, too. And I think it's one of the most unique stories that comes out of World War II.
Yeah, it really is. I'll tell you, that's
be true.
Really, it's a coincidence of major proportions, no question
now,
about it.
Now, he has told that story about finding my body. I got it on tape. I'll let you hear it when you get through with me.
Okay. That's very, very interesting. So, Guam, you finally were there when everything was kind of mopped up and secured, or?
No, that's where my trouble started.
Okay.
We was mopping up, and
Did you have occasion, by the way, to fire a weapon in anger against the Japs?
Well,
or were you too busy driving?
The closest I could have ever officially killed a Jap in person and known it didn't happen by accident. We had a machine gun nest set up on the beach, and I had the 10 till 2 watch.
Mm-hmm. Behind the machine gun.
I had the machine gun for 10 till 2, me and another guy. And from the moment we sat down, something was coming up that beach. We had this tall grass about 3 foot high, blade wire grass, something, I forgot what they call it, but every once in a while that grass would part for 50 feet, 10 feet or something, yeah, and stop. And it just kept getting closer and closer and closer. And by 2 o'clock, it was within 100 yards of us. And so I informed the Wilkerson boy that took over the machine gun when I crawled up on my Amtrak to go to sleep. Amtrak sitting on the beach. Tide was out. And so I figured the safest place I could be is under it. So I got my old blanket out, slipped up under the Amtrak, carried my rifle with me, of course, and proceeded to go to sleep. And the morning got my eyes shut, the machine gun started firing. It's like 2:30 in the morning. He fired off a whole bunch of rounds. Then he stopped. Then I heard a hand grenade go off. Then he shot some more. Then I heard another hand grenade go off. Never heard another sound of any kind until daylight. That's the hardest night I ever spent in my life. I thought the boys was all killed. I'm still laying under this.
Ooh.
Because he's close enough he could hear me, but I afraid to say anything.
Was it? Were there Japs approaching? Or?
Yeah.
There were.
At daylight then when we got up, there was two Japs. And both of them, one of them, he got his hand grenade out to throw it, and he come back like this, and that's when he cut loose a machine gun. And he cut him down, he shot him across the chest with a machine gun, and the hand grenade went off in his hand, blew his arm off.
Oh, my word.
That was the first one.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Then the second one went for his hand grenade, and he shot him in the belly, and it went off in his belly.
Oh, goodness.
And there's two Japs laying there dead, just two. Yeah. But they were within 20 feet of us.
Ooh, boy. They got that close.
Yeah.
Well, that tall grass is so, it hides them so well, huh?
It could have been a baby water buffalo. It could have been a dog. Yeah. Could have been a lot of things.
This is an editor's note. End of tape A, side 2. The interview continues on tape B, side 1.
Frightening night that night with those grenades going off and machine gun fire. You didn't get much sleep, I take it.
Didn't get any. I couldn't wait till daylight to see what happened.
Yeah, right.
And to my surprise, there were two dead Japs there, but we was all okay.
Yeah. So did you have any other instances where the Japs were, you know, coming, infiltrating into your areas?
No, we had that.
Any other instances?
Well, I don't believe there's any other instance where the Japs while my brother was there, but we had some come in. Oh, so often that the company commander finally set up a guard post, put two men on duty to watch camp all night.
Now, were these infiltrators looking for food, do you think, or were they actually going to do damage?
I think they were just looking for food because we captured a few of them, and the one that we killed had a knife, I think. I know at least two occasions he had a knife, the ones that we captured had no weapon of any kind.
They couldn't do
naked
it.
And starving.
Yeah.
And they just come out of the hills and thought they could get in our commissary and get something to eat.
Yeah.
That's what I would think.
Tell me about the time when your brother was there when you had one in your tent. Describe that night.
I think he can tell that better. But I think I slept too until he fired, but when Wilkerson fired the rifle, I knew there was something going on. And,
so you were just asleep in the tent,
yeah,
you and your brother?
I sleep too.
Okay.
But
and then didn't hear any indication of anything going on?
No indication of any kind, but I guess the Jap thought he was sneaking in the commissary and he happened to be sneaking into our tent. And so he recognized me, he shot him.
So somebody was obviously awake then and had a gun right next to him, so
we had guards on duty. And
oh, that was the guard that shot him.
The guard that shot him.
Oh, okay, the guard shot him. I thought it was somebody in the tent. So it was the guard that shot him. Okay.
I can tell you. I'll tell you this real funny incident that happened there. That Colonel Peck, when he died, this year. But I went to his funeral at Arlington. Mm-hmm. He had a pet chicken. Native would give him a little banny rooster. And that little rooster would start crowing about 4 o'clock every morning. And all over the camp, somebody would holler, somebody would shoot him. Waking everybody up, especially on Sunday. And so me and another boy had guard duty one night from 2 to 6, 2 to 8, whatever. We went on at 2 o'clock and had to be there at daylight. About 2:30, 3 o'clock, that rooster started crowing. Yaxit says, "I'll match you for him." So we flipped a coin. And I don't know what I won or lost, but I had to shoot the chicken.
So you did shoot the chicken?
I shot the chicken, blew his head slam off. And that woke up the camp, I'll tell you right now it did. But he was captain at that time. Captain Peck hit the deck. He had him a little deck built in front of his tent. He hit the deck with both feet barefooted, nothing on but his shorts, was putting on his 45 gun belt. And his dead chicken lay in between his legs.
Now, what happened after that?
Colonel Peck died not knowing who shot his chicken.
What did Colonel Peck have to say to the troops? The guys that were in the Marines?
He put me on guard duty for 2 weeks. Uh-huh. And I had to stay on that guard duty for 2 weeks, for two more weeks. Was shooting his chicken, and the other guy too. Well, he never did find out which one did.
Oh, he knew it was one of the two.
He knew one of them did, but we knew one of them wouldn't admit to it.
Now, why did he suspect one of you two?
We was on two out there that had a rifle.
Okay.
We was up.
You were the ones that were there, huh, with the weapon. Okay, so well, tell me more about Guam. Then, how long did you stay on Guam? And
well, I'm gonna tell you the part that just about put me away for life.
Okay, all right.
Not with a gun, though. But this was at Guam. It was after my brother left. I hadn't told you what caused this. What started all this? Start with though. This happened. I had something really strange to happen to me coming in on the beach at Agate Bay. When we went right, I've been hauling ammunition up to that dump I told you, a mile up in the woods. Was up there unloaded the load of ammunition one day, and this Army lieutenant came over and ordered me to take some wounded soldiers out to hospital ship. I said, "We're not supposed to do that." And he argued with me a little bit, and he said, I'm a commissioned officer, and I want this tractor, I'm commandeering this tractor to take these soldiers out to hospital ship." So I did what I was supposed to do. I got his name, rank, and serial number. And I said, "Okay, it's at your disposal. What do you want us to do with it?" He said, "Load these men up. Let's take them to hospital ship." He had 5 wounded soldiers out there. Every one of them was Japs.
Oh, they were Japs.
And I didn't feel like we should be wasting our time hauling these Japs to hospital ship when we didn't have enough people out there to take care of our wounded Marines and our own soldiers. But I couldn't argue with him about it. So I took them out there. And the madder I got, the more further I got out, the madder I got. But we got them out there and tied up to a rope hanging down the side, a net. And he hollered up to some officer and told him to send a gurney down. He's going to bring a wounded soldier. But first one he sends up, somebody's up on the deck, hollers back, "That's a damn Jap." And then him and the lieutenant on my tractor got in an argument, and finally the lieutenant told him that he had to take them aboard. International law, he had to take them. So he agreed with him. He took them aboard and said goodbye to us. We won at the time. We sent them up on a gurney. And when they got the last one up there, he told me to could proceed to go back to the beach. And so to get back to the beach, I had to go around the bow of the ship and around the other side to get to the beach. And when I went around the other side of the ship, they were dumping them in the ocean. They drowned all five of them mm-hmm. right there. And I was afraid to tell my company commander about it. I didn't sleep a wink for a week, I know. It just tore me up. That's pure murder. I mean, just I didn't think Americans could do that to the enemy. I disagreed with taking them out there because I thought they'd be taking the place of a Marine, but
yeah, right.
Once I found out what they did to them, they took them aboard just to get rid of this little second lieutenant and they dumped him in the ocean. I took this little yellow piece of paper where I had his name and address and serial number and threw it in the ocean and said, I ain't going to tell nobody about it. I tried to keep it a secret. And from that day forward, I didn't have much to do with officers anymore, especially second lieutenants.
Did anybody ever find out that that's what they did with them, that you know of?
Nobody except me and the guys on my tractor.
And the people
aboard? That second lieutenant, he knew it. No, he didn't do nothing about it. And there wasn't nothing I could do about it.
Oh, the second lieutenant was riding back with you.
He rode back with us, yeah.
And he saw it too, so.
He's the one that ordered to scare him out there. I expect he went away feeling like I did. I don't know.
But he saw these men being thrown over too.
All right. But now, sometime between then and all the other things that happened, I blanked that whole mess out of my mind. I just blanked it out. I didn't know. When it came back to him, I still didn't know why I blanked it out. But I think I know now. It's just it was an atrocity that my body and my mind didn't want to take.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't want to be involved in something like that. And we got back up to, I got back up, when we set this camp up in up above Aganya City, where the picture of the tents I showed you, mm-hmm. I started having a problem up there with sergeants. Anybody would give me an order, you know, I'd snap at them, you know. I wasn't getting along too good. It looked like I was having a nervous breakdown or something. But I couldn't sleep at night. I go to sleep at night and all I could see was bodies falling out of the sky all night long.
Mm-hmm.
And one Sunday morning, this happened. My best friend, a fellow from, he's a New York City policeman, retired now, of course, and he's dead now, of course, too. He died 2 years ago. His name was William Joseph Hall. Me and him remained friends the rest of our life and stayed together until he died. He died 2 years ago. We didn't have a tent to sleep on. We're sleeping in a tarpaulin. He had the middle bunk next to a pass going up a hill. Up a cliff, really, a 50-foot high cliff. And I had the bunk next to him, and we had mosquito nets on. And a Jap sneaked down that hill one night and was coming down on him with a knife going right in his face.
Mm-hmm.
And out, we had a security guard under the tent, and he saw what was happening. He shot him. The Jap still fell right through that mosquito net into his face, and the knife went right past his head. He had to roll him off of him to get out from under him.
Mm.
And he got kind of shook up about that. He wasn't no sleep on that end tent no more. I told him I'd swap beds with him. So I swapped bunks with him. I moved my bunk in his space and he moved his in mine. We went on about our business and it happened on a Sunday morning too. One Sunday morning, I saw two Japs coming down that hill. A little before daylight. And I had a .45 pistol, had it under my head, under my pillow. I reached down and got my pistol, and I set up on the edge of the bed, and I unloaded in both of them. That, in my mind, was the first time I'd ever shot a Jap and knew that I was doing it.
Mm-hmm.
But within 15 minutes after I'd done that, my whole bunk was surrounded by military police. I had shot up two stumps. There's no Japs coming down. There's no Japs coming down that hill. Captain came out there and told them to take me to the hospital. They took me to Base 18 Naval Hospital down below Ganya, Agate Bay, rather. Sometime in November, and not a single person from the company ever came down to check on me. Nobody ever called down there to ask me anything. I tried to call up the company and couldn't get nobody. Nobody knew how to call them. And they put me in a psychiatric ward, and these doctors started talking to me about my mother and my father. Did they beat you and all that stuff when you was little? I clammed up. I wouldn't tell anybody nothing. I know now there's the wrong thing to do, but I just froze. I wouldn't tell them nothing. So they decided I was a mental case, and basket case, I reckon, and shipped me back home.
Because you'd fired these two stumps?
Yeah.
I mean, isn't it logical that somebody could... I mean, was it dark or was it light?
It was dark.
I mean, isn't it logical just that somebody could assume that those were two men out there?
I did.
I know you did. Isn't that logical that somebody
But they all said I was crazy because there wasn't no Japs there, so...
Yeah.
They put me on a... I stayed there till December 31st. No, before the end. I don't remember when I sailed from there, but I landed at this... They put me on a hospital ship.
Mm-hmm.
And I landed in San Francisco on the 31st day of December that year.
Mm-hmm.
And from there, they put me on a hospital train and carried me to Norfolk Naval Hospital. They kept me in a mental ward down there for 5 months, almost 6 months. And they finally told me they were going to give me a medical discharge and 50% service-connected disability and send me home. So they did. I came home and got married and raised a family. And 2 years after I got home, they sent me over to Winston-Salem for a psychiatric evaluation and told me there wasn't nothing wrong with me. Took disability away from me. And all this time, I'm still having these nightmares about these bodies falling out of the eye, out of the sky.
Yeah.
And it wasn't too long before me and my wife didn't sleep together no more. I'd kick her out of the bed. For years and years, my bed looked like two wildcats fighting, been fighting in it all night.
Mm-hmm.
When I'd get up in the morning, I never got a good night's sleep because I'd wake up every night just about with them bodies falling out of the sky. It's been almost 10 years ago now that I woke up and realized what it was. In fact, that whole scene came back to me about 10 years ago under some circumstances at the Durham VA hospital that I'm sure they did not plan it for me.
So you had basically just driven this out of your mind.
Yeah. I drove it out of my mind.
Mm-hmm.
And about 10 years ago, they was having a disaster drill at the Durham VA hospital. And I had no reason to even stay to see it. I'd done seen my doctor and was on my way home. And they said, it's going to happen, you know, going to have it in a couple of hours, y'all stick around and watch it. So I hung around for 2 hours just to watch it. And when I saw all these wounded soldiers coming in with their rags tied around their heads and all that stuff, and some of them, all it was superficial, you know, wasn't nothing real, but they had made it look good. All of a sudden, I just saw them. I saw what was happening. I saw me driving around that ship, looking at them, seeing them guys throw them off.
Mm-hmm.
And I just went down in that, ground floor and went in one of the staff bathroom down there and just sit on a commode back there and sit there for 3 hours, maybe longer, until it all came back.
Mm-hmm.
And then after it all came back, I was scared to tell my doctors about it. Took me about another year and a half to start talking to them about it.
Mm-hmm.
But I finally did. And now, since I've done that, I've been in a group of POWs and MIAs down there mm-hmm. for 8-9 years now. And we worked with other people who had the problem like I had.
Mm-hmm.
And one of my men wrote a letter. See, they finally told me that the reason I didn't read and they took my compensation away from me was because I couldn't prove where I was at. I wasn't anywhere. They had a record of me leaving San Diego, going overseas, and had a record of me coming back in San Francisco. Nothing else.
Was it?
They told me I'd have to find some of my people who was with me to prove it. So I got a letter I'm going to let you read before you leave that Colonel Ward Rice wrote. And they reinstated my pension as soon as they got that letter. No questions asked.
Is that right?
And they didn't give me no back pay, but they raised it to 100%.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been able to make it. And but it's been awful hard. I went for 45, 50 years not knowing why I was that way and thinking I was crazy. But since then, I've learned a lot about this stuff. And
yeah. You had some demons that were working at you, no question about
yeah,
that.
Yeah, but I had some good ones and some bad ones. I had some good ones working with me, too, that got me out of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So you came back from the service, came back to Leakesville, I guess, at the time? And
I came back to Leakesville and got a job at the cigarette factory. In fact, I was discharged before the war ended in Japan. I was married and living in Washington, D.C. when they dropped the first atomic bomb.
Oh.
I think. I may be wrong about that.
But anyhow, what took you to Washington, D.C.?
I moved up there to go to work. But that was later, though. VJ Day, I was working in a cigarette factory.
Mm-hmm. Where, in Reeseville?
In Reeseville. I wasn't married then.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
My fiancée, Pam's mother, came over there and told me, said, let's go celebrate the Japs, the war's over in Japan. I told my boss man, I'm going to check out and celebrate the victory in Japan. He said, if you touch that machine, he said, if you touch that clock, you're fired. So I just run over and marked my card and told him to shove it. I said, I'm out of here. I didn't go back.
I don't blame you.
So we went out and celebrated it.
Mm-hmm.
Now I'm thinking of that time I said dropping atomic bombs when I was in Washington was when I dropped them on the enemy talk.
Oh, yeah.
That was a test, you know.
Yeah, test, right.
But I think I was still in Norfolk Naval Hospital when they dropped that bomb. I'm not sure.
Mm-hmm.
I know I was there when Iwo Jima. I would have went to Iwo Jima if I stayed there. My company went.
That was the next spot on the
company I was with went.
Mm-hmm. Well, you were fortunate you didn't have to go there. You had enough. You'd seen enough, I'd say. So you came back to Leakesville eventually. You were in D.C., of course, and you were working up there.
I worked up there a year for a fellow named Ray Hodges. He was a nephew of Governor Luther Hodges.
Oh, yeah.
At an Exxon SO service station.
Mm-hmm.
I worked there for about a year with him. Got married while I was doing that. Mm-hmm. Borrowed $100 to go on a honeymoon with.
And then did you move back down here?
I moved back down here and I went in the car business with one of my brothers and stayed with him for about 15 years. Then we separated and I went on my own and I opened up a motorcycle shop. I ran a motorcycle shop for 16 years and I've dabbled with used cars off and on ever since.
Oh, really? Maybe I need to see you about a used car.
Okay. I just rented my place to somebody else.
Oh, you did? Well, let me ask you some other questions, if I could. Mr. Griffith, you've done a good job of describing your experience, I must say. Oh. When you were in the invasions of Guam, for example, did you find that you had enough supplies to do what you needed to do in your job? I mean, did you, and the troops that were fighting there, was supplies and ammunition, food, was it ever a problem, or did you feel like you had everything you needed to do the job there?
We had everything we needed, but it wasn't given to us. We confiscated.
Oh, really?
When we got everything else done, we started hauling all kinds of stuff ashore.
Uh-huh.
Navy hospital.
Yeah.
We hauled hospital towels and officers' clubs. We hauled a liquor ashore.
Uh-huh.
We hauled everything.
Right.
And the colonel told us when we started doing this, he said, "Don't forget, we don't have no supplies." So we'd always save a little to drop off at the company. And I carried a load of boxes one time up to Army barracks for the U.S. Army that was stationed there somewhere. And I throwed off a case in the woods on the way up and picked it up on the way back. Had no idea what was in the box. Got home, I had 100 alarm clocks. So we don't come to that. Everybody had his own alarm clock.
That's hilarious. Oh, my, that's the last thing you needed, too, I guess, isn't it?
And we confiscated a Japanese truck, and we overhauled it, done everything, got it running, and painted it, and we had the prettiest truck on the island. A 29 Chevrolet, I think what it was.
Oh, it was a U.S. model, huh?
Yeah, but no, it was a Nissan or something, but it looked like the same as that Chevrolet.
Oh, okay.
And the company commander, two guys in my outfit, we hauled Army supplies, I told you. They hauled some Army dress uniforms for officers. Somewhere or another, they got a hold of a pair of them.
Mm-hmm.
And they dressed up. And they went down to the ship where they was unloading some Jeeps. Cause told me to come after that Jeep. They said, "It's that one right there." The guy drove it off. They brought that Jeep up and put it under the tent, painted Marine Corps colors. And we give it to the captain.
Uh-huh.
So here he is, a little lowly captain driving a brand stinking new Jeep. And the colonel for the... And the 3rd Marine Colonel that was over us, I've forgotten his name, he came down one day and saw that new Jeep. He said, "Captain Peck," he said, "just don't look right. You a captain driving a new Jeep, and me a colonel driving this old ragged boy out one." He said, "We're going to swap." Captain Peck said, "Yes, sir, Colonel." So they traded Jeeps.
Uh-huh.
Now the colonel's riding a hot Jeep, not the captain.
That's funny. When you were in combat, what type of uniform did you wear, and what did you carry with you? What did you have on your person? Did you have?
I had a. They first issued me a 03, and somewhere along the line, it was traded in on a M1, but I don't think I got the M1 until I went to Guam. I had the 03 at the Marshall Islands.
You're talking about the Springfield 03?
Yeah.
That a real old one. Yeah.
World War One weapon.
Yeah, sure. Yeah.
But I was the only one in boot camp that got one. Everybody else got a M1.
Uh-huh.
But I didn't get an M1 until I got to Guam. We used them. We went on patrols with them and done a lot of things with them. And
what did you wear, actually?
Oh, clothing, fatigues? And everything.
Fatigues?
Well, boondocks and fatigues and a helmet for sure, a gun belt. And if we used an amphibian tractor, we wore a pellet-driven life preserver.
What's a pellet-driven? Something you just...
Yeah, just squeeze it and blow it up, two little rubber tubes around your waist.
Uh-huh. Right.
And it went out on an amp track. We always had those on.
Uh-huh.
And we did a lot of that stuff, going from one island to another on Amtrak's hauling supplies.
Now, were you on your Amtrak? Did you have a weapon with you? Of course, you had a machine gun.
We had every crew chief was issued a .45 caliber pistol,
okay,
M1 rifle, Elgin watch,
uh-huh,
We had supplies. 3rd Marine Division had picked us up. 10th Amphibian Tract gave us enough supplies for a whole battalion.
Uh-huh.
They thought we were a whole battalion. It was only a company of us.
Gee, wait.
But we had battalion supplies. So everybody had a rifle.
So you had
everybody had a pistol. Everybody had everything.
More than anything that you needed, I guess, huh? What is your impression of the leadership that you had when you were doing all these things?
Well, I know now we had excellent leadership, but after I'd done that one job for that little second lieutenant, I never could get off my mind. I didn't like nothing the officer had to say to me anymore after that. I just felt arrogant about him for some reason. Mm-hmm. You know, if he told me something I need to do, I was afraid to do it, afraid I'd get in trouble again.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm afraid not to do it. So.
Yeah, right. You did it out of fear one way or the other, huh? But basically, you feel like the leadership that you had was good.
Huh? Very good. Now, this colonel, this captain I had over there, he retired lieutenant colonel.
Mm-hmm.
And I was with him at a reunion last year in Gettysburg. And he sat down at the table and he's looking at me and he says, "Bethel, what happened? What caused you to have to come home?" I said, "Don't you know?" He said, I wouldn't do that to one of my troops. You know I wouldn't do that to one of my troops. He said, you know I didn't pull you out of combat and send you home." I said, "Well, if you didn't do it, who in the hell was in charge?" He said,
"Good question.
I'm guilty," he said. But we buried him February this year.
Mm-hmm. Did you have any... or did you notice any difference between the academy graduates, if you had any, and the might say the OCS type officers?
About all the officers we had were college graduates, and then they went to school for a few months. And
but no academy graduates.
No academies I know of.
Probably. How about discipline problems? Did you were aware of any? Particular discipline problems among the troops?
Not necessarily. I never had a discipline problem until I had that little problem with that one officer.
Mm-hmm.
And after that, I never was punished for anything except that time I shot the chicken.
Yeah. Well, I was thinking not necessarily about you, but just in general, was there any?
In general, no. Everybody was pretty good.
They were pretty focused on what they were doing. Eh?
Focused on what they were doing, right.
Did you have any, was there any AWOLs or folks who just kind of got away from it all?
None overseas. None overseas. We might have had some of those at these camp bases at home. But
nowhere to go, I guess, was there?
Nowhere to go overseas.
Overseas.
No money either.
Yeah, that's true. Did you ever... Even in combat, did you ever have any time, what you would call spare time? Or were you totally focused on just what you were doing all the time?
Time went so fast while I was in combat, I'm sure I had my mind on exactly what I'm doing and nothing else.
Yeah.
You had a job to do and you had to keep your mind on it. You couldn't let nothing distract you.
Yeah, if you did, you were liable to wind up dead.
Well, you're liable to anyhow. I don't, it's a miracle any of us came back.
Well, especially as you were saying, so many of those Amtraks lost from that gun, and you were below the...
I never did get around to telling you about that day that I got they put me on the committee to go down and move those bodies.
No.
We had bags to put them in, and we was ordered to get the whole body in one bag if we could, and... You could pick them up by the feet and they'd fall off at the hips or knees, joints, and neck could come off. And sometimes it just awful mess you ever seen, put them in a bag.
It just crushes you to think about it.
And I don't know, it was about 20 of us, I guess, had to go down there. And I don't remember how many we'd done, but we had 12 tractor loads of all Americans. That's what hurt.
Oh, you must have had hundreds.
Must have been.
I mean, you figured 20, 25 people in a...
Yeah. Might have been some, might have been a few escaped. I don't know if they got every person on, yeah. though, but most of them, belly was full of them.
Yeah, killed by the concussion of the shell hitting in him. Did you, were you able to keep up with the progress of the war at all, or were you just kind of doing what you were doing and didn't really know what was going on?
We heard about Eisenhower fixing to make the June 6th landing. Mm-hmm. We heard about that, I think. That was in, when was that?
June 6, 1944.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I had to be on Guam at that time mm-hmm. then. And in June, we were stationed on Guam there, and we heard that message. And it was amazing to us how many people they had. If we had all the men lined up, that hit every island in the Pacific, had them lined up in a row, wouldn't have been 10% of what they mm-hmm. had on that one beach in Normandy.
Yeah, that was incredible. What's your impression of the enemy that you were fighting?
Then or now?
Done.
Then.
We're talking about World War II now.
Then I thought they was what we was told they were.
And what was that?
Unfit to be living. That you couldn't trust them for nothing, and most of them I run across was like they said. But now I never seen a full dressed Japanese soldier alive. Only Japanese soldiers I ever seen alive was practically naked.
Uh-huh.
And that still bears into my mind how much that they taught us to hate them.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think that's the right way to win a war, but we did win that. But I don't think you ought to teach the troops to hate the enemy. But we were taught to kill or be killed.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's
and that part I can understand.
Yeah, in your situation, that was pretty much it. Any impression of the tactics they used, the organization of the enemy and so forth? Any particular impression of that?
I don't guess I was close enough to any Japanese headquarters to understand what they was doing, what they was yeah. trying to do. Didn't know until after it was over, you know, what their plans were.
Yeah.
To me, they just looked like an unorganized bunch of people that trying to escape from with a life,
yeah.
most of them.
Yeah.
But then again, when I walk out through the fields, through the dead bodies, you know, there were some sharp-looking Japs out there with them swords on. This is all dead.
Going back again to kind of your combat experience, do you recollect what your frame of mind was and what your feelings were as you knew that you were going to be putting yourself at a very high degree of risk?
It's a feeling you'll only have one time in your life, and that's when you face it. And I don't believe I could ever have that feeling again. It's just like halfway in space. You know, I know I got to do this. I don't know I'm going to make it, but I got to do it anyhow.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's probably the way I would approach it too, I think. How about the morale of your unit? Anything particularly to be said about that? The overall morale of the guys?
I think the overall morale of this company while I was in it was very good.
Mm-hmm. Is there anything that affected morale, like lack of mail or not getting paid or, you know, whatever?
Well, I got one mail call in Guam in August, and I got that cake my sister sent me a year before, and mm-hmm. it was a ball of dust. I think we salvaged a pack of chewing gum out of that 40-pound package, yeah. about all.
Mm-hmm. So how about mail, though? Was this was important to you, I'm sure.
Well, I caught up on some mail there. I got letters that had been sent a year before.
Mm-hmm.
I got a sea bag full of mail.
Really?
And out of this sea bag, I got a letter from one of my sisters telling me that my daddy had got remarried again, and he had married a 18-year-old girl. He was 58.
Ooh.
I'm sitting there reading this letter, and my friend Bill All comes by, and he says, "What's the matter, Griff? I said, you don't want to know. Come on, tell me what's going on. He's from New York. I said, well, I'll tell you what's going on. I said, my daddy just joined the damn Marine Air Corps and he's flying Corsairs up at Saipan. Well,
okay.
The next day then, Captain Peck called me in the office. What's this about your daddy flying airplanes at Saipan? Had to tell him the truth.
Oh, my. Yeah, you'd rather not talk about that.
Yeah.
Did you hear any enemy propaganda in any form, you know, like Tokyo Rose or anything when you were on ship or anything?
Oh, we enjoyed listening to Tokyo Rose. We listened to it on ship and on the island, too.
You did? So yeah. You had a radio then, huh?
Yeah. Somebody in the company always had a radio.
That's amazing.
We had radios on the Amtraks.
Oh, you did?
Well, we had, you know, the kind you call in, call out on, but we could rig them before we pick up stations.
Oh, you could rig them so they would pick up, huh?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I see. So you listened to Tokyo Rose. What did you enjoyed listening to her?
We enjoyed listening to her. She played popular songs, music we liked.
Did you think that she was pretty, you know, the information she gave out about maybe specific units and so forth, was she pretty accurate on that?
Oh, we just laughed about it. I don't know. Yeah, a whole lot of it was true, but we just laughed about it. We thought everything she said was funny. Some reason that I had in my mind that she was a real beautiful woman.
Yeah.
I think it was a voice.
Yeah, I think so too.
Oops, I got to put this thing back on here. Were any of the men that you know of, or any situation occurred where any of your Marines were captured by the Japs?
No. I never heard of a Marine getting captured over there.
You captured plenty of Japs,
We didn't capture plenty, we captured a few.
Did you?
Like, for instance, where that 3,500 Japs was at, I think we took 120 prisoners.
And the rest of them were killed?
Yeah.
And did any of them, would you say, commit harakiri? Did they commit suicide? Or
quite a few of them did.
They did?
Yeah.
When they got into a situation where they were going to be captured? Or
some of the higher officers would commit harakiri, soldiers wouldn't be.
Yeah. Okay. Do you ever go and see any movies about World War II
that interest you?
I have the a new one on DVD. Watched it last week.
We talking about Saving Private Ryan or what?
No, the other one.
Pearl Harbor?
No, one. Windtalkers.
Oh, Windtalkers, yeah.
Did you see that?
No, but I know that took place in, you know, where
it was. The combat was so real.
Really?
That it just, I said in tears half the time.
Really? I've got to see that. Have you got that on DVD, you say?
I got it on DVD.
Do you? Well, I'd like to really like to
see
that.
Came out a couple of weeks ago. Yeah. Walmart got it for about $20, I think.
Yeah. I may have to talk to you about that.
And I'll loan it to you if you want to look at it.
It's interesting to me. See, I wanted to interview one of the Windtalkers.
I always wondered what them two Indians doing in my company.
Oh, you had them in your company?
Two.
Is that right?
But I didn't know what they're there for.
Yeah.
I know now.
So you had some Windtalkers in your company?
Yeah, but I don't know. If anybody was ordered to look after them, I never did know about it.
Uh-huh. But that's the reason they were there, though.
I did know that they talked a lot of their language, and I did know that most of them was radio operators.
Is that right? That's most interesting that you would have been involved with some of those folks. I know that they were, you know, obviously they had a code that nobody could crack.
All it was their natural language.
Right, but it was, to the Japs, it was a code.
Yeah.
It was just a language nobody knew.
Well, we would have lost the war without them. That's how important they were.
Yeah, I gather. I gather.
All these past presidents let George Bush recognize them. Should have been done 50 years
ago. Oh, yeah, sure. Well, it said, I want to interview. I read an article about them, and I want to interview one if I can. I don't know where I have to travel to do it, but I'd like to do it. Can you characterize your service? Maybe a... By what it all meant to you and what it means to you today. Is there anything that you can kind of crystallize out of all this that you did?
Well, I do know that when World War II started immediately after Pearl Harbor, there was no lacking of people wanting to go. Everybody wanted to go that I knew.
Yeah.
Just about everybody I knew was able to go, did go. And patriotism, I think, was much higher than it's ever been since.
Right, probably so.
And it's kind of like the case they tried in Washington here a few weeks ago where some people sued the World War II Memorial Foundation to try to get the government not to put that thing on the mall up there, mm-hmm. because that was hallowed ground where some yeah. famous man made a march at.
Mm-hmm.
But the judge was smart enough to say, we know it's hallowed ground. But he said it was hallowed ground a long, long before this man was ever born. And so there's people like these World War II veterans, one caused it to be that way.
Mm-hmm.
So they're going to build that thing there, whether you like it or not. So yeah. they're back at work on it now.
Yeah, I'm happy to hear that. Well, getting back to you personally, what do you think about what you did?
I think what I did and what everybody did in World War II is the reason we can be free now.
Yeah, very true. Very true.
There's no doubt in my mind that we'd have been speaking Japanese or German one.
Is there any particular event in your experience that you, of course, you maybe you've already mentioned it, that kind of sticks with you?
Yeah, from those days. I've already told you about.
Right. I figured that would be it. How did your experience change your life?
I don't know. I'm sure it did somehow. To start with, I don't know how I came back alive. And I still think there's something I'm supposed to do that I haven't got around to yet. I'm still searching.
Well, I pray that you have time to do it. Anything else you want to add to this interview?
I think I said enough.
Okay, well, let's check our tape here, make sure we're getting this on here. Yeah, we are. Well, that'll conclude our interview with Mr. Bethel Griffith, and I thank you very much for your time, sir, and I know that there'll be a lot of people who'll be interested in hearing the story you got to tell.
Thank you. Thank you.